You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome in Rose City to another edition of the Soccer Made in Portland podcast. I'm Ryan Clark, joined by Chris Reifer. And Chris, we have continually discussed the weather on this wonderful podcast pretty much right out of the gate. And you take a look at the good old-fashioned weather app for those with Apple products, and you see 70-degree days relatively consistently in the coming week, which bodes extremely well for my mental health.
So naturally, I am headed off this afternoon to go to Crater Lake for the weekend.
Oh,
so
nice.
It's going to be much colder. I'm like, it looks like we're going to have a delightful weekend in Portland. So I am out. Peace. See y'all later. I'm going to go where it's still pretty dang cold.
Yeah.
But it is also very nice there. And it looks like it's going to be brilliant. Just, you know, just nice puffer jacket weather.
What are you camping up there?
I actually got a spot at the lodge. I've never stayed there. I haven't even been to Crater Lake since I was like a kid.
Me either.
And so we sort of just like put in, you know, months and months ago, we just put in for a random weekend that we could find to get a spot at the lodge, because it's a little bit difficult to get a room. And got lucky, grabbed a room. And so I'm kind of looking forward to that. It feels like a very Oregonian experience that as a fifth generation Oregonian, I have been missing out on. So I'll be going to check out Oregon's only national park.
The only one.
Is there another place in Oregon that you think is national park worthy that is getting the shaft?
Ooh.
In the national park stuff? Got to be some spots on the coast, I would think.
You know, the Painted Hills seem like an area should be a contender.
I think that's the one.
Yeah, I think if you have to pick one, that would have to be it. It's just so remote though that people genuinely forget about it. You know, it's an incredible, breathtaking part. And there are parts of the coast too that definitely, could be in contention for that all along the Oregon coast.
Yeah. Parts of the Southern Oregon coast in particular, I think are super, super cool. And I mean, sort of like the Painted Hills, that's not nearly as remote or out of the way, but there are parts of the Southern Oregon coast that are just breathtaking. And that very much sort of rival some of the parts of our various coasts that do get more recognition, but that are just spectacular. You can often see like whale migration going through there because it's a super heavily trafficked area. There's some parts there, but I think your shout for the Painted Hills is right. If any place in Oregon, is, you know, getting the snub for national park recognition, I think it's the Painted Hills, notwithstanding the fact that they are in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Right. Yeah. I don't think we have a particularly high chance of doing a live podcast from the Painted Hills anytime soon, just given the cell service.
Coverage is spotty.
Yeah. Yeah. Coverage is a little spotty. Not a lot of Wi-Fi hotspots.
Would be a big transformation though for the city / town of Burns.
Yeah.
If that got the christening, the one in the broader Northwest that I am somewhat passionate about because I think it deserves national park recognition, that it doesn't have it. But then on the other hand, I sort of would like to keep it a little bit quieter as it is. Mm. Are the Sawtooth Mountains in Idaho? They're like on the merits. There should absolutely be a Sawtooth National Park, but there is not. And in some ways that works out because it's still a place that you can go and find some relative solitude.
Yeah. You know, I think that the Northwest in general is chock full of those things. And, you know, I don't want to you know, infringe on the Peak Northwest podcast territory too much here, but we are two gentlemen who enjoy the beautiful state that we live in. So
you're bringing to an end our long running podcast, National Parks Made in Portland.
Yes, I think that the podcast that began on today, May 19th, 2022, can come to a bitter end now, because, again, we don't want the folks at Peak Northwest to be like, what are you doing? Come on, you're taking up our space. So,
that's right.
So soccer, which is made in Portland, that's our discussion.
A lot of it made in Portland recently.
Yes, a ton of it. I've been out at a bunch of it. The Thorns, we'll start with them. Drew the OL Reign 0-0 last Saturday, and then last night, Wednesday, drew the Washington Spirit 1-1. Two really high-quality clubs that, to me, will be among the final few teams left at the end of the year, I think, with the Thorns when it comes to those contending for an NWSL championship. I thought that the Thorns played them very well in stretches, but they also, as Reen Wilkinson pointed out last night, had some difficulties in terms of finding consistency and, you know, finishing those high quality chances that they're getting. You know, I mean, Morgan Weaver is making great runs. Sophia Smith is doing what she does. Christine Sinclair is still a force, still playing 80 plus minutes late in her career. So, you know, the opportunities are there, and they have stretches where they look elite. But against these teams like OL Reign, like Washington Spirit, who defend phenomenally well, and I think that's a calling card really for the top teams in NWSL is their ability to defend. I think they can be happy to get a point out of each of those matches. You know, taking a loss in either of them would have been tough for confidence standpoint. But they also had chances in both of those matches to win. And if you come out of both of those matches with wins, you're 3-0, and having defeated two teams that are among the class of the NWSL. So, you know, some things to be happy about going forward, and it is early in the season, but, you know, when you get those opportunities against those great teams, you got to take advantage of them and get those victories, even if it is early on.
Yeah. You know, the Reign game, I think, is the one that they'll probably look back on and rue some of the chances that they missed. I thought the Thorns were the better team in that game by some distance. I you know, sort of like the last game against the Reign, I thought the Thorns did a really nice job of dictating the game. The chances that they had were far superior to the chances that the Reign had. They were frankly just a little bit sloppy in the final third. They got into a lot of spots. I mean, it was almost like some of what we've experienced at times with the Timbers this year, where they got into a ton of really good spots and then just were not sharp in sort of converting, getting into those spots into goals. You know, that happens. It's soccer. It's a hard game. Scoring goals is the hardest thing to do. That's why it doesn't happen a lot. So that happens. But it's also, you know, sort of a cautionary tale that for, you know, all of the good work that you can do over the course of a game, if you want to beat really good teams like the Reign and even like the Spirit, you've got to be really sharp to do it. And even at home, this is... I think, you know, in some respects, this is you know, sort of just a reality, and it's a reality that everybody should be pretty comfortable with at this point. That NWSL is not sort of the kind of league that is there to be dominated. I actually think Reen Wilkinson on Twitter sort of nodded at this point in a post game tweet. It may have even been this morning. You know, when she said kind of like, what a league. And that's right. There are a number of teams that are really good in this league you can't be a Leon, or you can't be a Wolfsburg or something like that. And sort of just expect that against basically every other team in the league, you can put in a B performance and get a win. If you want to beat the Reign, even at home, you got to play really well. You got to be really sharp. If you want to beat the Spirit, even at home, you got to play really well. I think there were things to like in both performances. I think, frankly, the Thorns weren't as good against the Spirit, especially in the first half. I thought they were really sluggish, and frankly, I thought the Spirit were really winning the X's and O's game in the first half. But you know, I mean, the bottom line is, if you have those kinds of challenges against these teams, the league is good enough and the league is deep enough that that's not going to get the job done, and that's where the thorns are. Taking 2 points from these last couple games at home, from which they certainly would have liked to, and in some ways looked like they could get more.
Absolutely, and I think that Spirit team in particular defended so well in that first half and limited a lot of the things that the Thorns like to do. There were also issues of tactical decisions and who Reen decided to start versus who she brought in for the second half. So you start out with Rocky Rodriguez in the midfield and only two up top with Sink and Sophia. And I don't know how often you can afford to make a move like that. Yes, Rocky is a great player and she played admirably well in the first half despite the strength of the Spirit's defense. But Morgan Weaver is a player that can't really be shoehorned into being just a second half sub because she made such an incredible difference with her play when she came on in the second half. And then you have somebody else like Janine Becky, who if you are going to play those three the entire game, if one of them needs a substitute, more often than not, it'll probably be Christine Sinclair. You bring Becky on and she's a starting caliber player. And she didn't even get in last night. You know, that she's somebody who would start on a lot of NWSL teams, and she was a DNP. So
right. The thing that I thought really, really troubled the Thorns, and I'm not sure why this was, because this hasn't been a problem when they've played in sort of a similar setup and sort of a 3-5-2 setup in the past. But they were really, really, really getting squeezed by the Spirit. And you're right that it was just really hard for the Thorns, frankly, to build up through the middle. And so the typically excellent play and progressive play that we see from Hino Sugiria was just being choked off by the Spirit. I thought Rocky Rodriguez did not have a lot of room to move. I really felt like especially Christine Sinclair got isolated being moved up into one of the forward roles, which I thought led to that halftime move of bringing Weaver on for Rodriguez, which I thought was 100% the right move. I think that's one that Reen Wilkinson really nailed, because whereas the game was getting really compressed and it felt like the Thorns over and over and over again were having to play into really just the teeth of the Spirit central midfield, I thought once Weaver came on, she did a good job of stretching the field vertically, of basically using her pace and her threat in behind that Sink wasn't able to provide, to stretch the field, to give a little bit more space for Sink when she was able to drop in a little bit deeper. What was curious to me and what I didn't understand is obviously when you play in a 3-5-2 or any sort of setup where you have a 3 or 5 player back line, you're going to be counting on your wingbacks to provide a lot of that mid possession width. And they just weren't. And I didn't exactly figure out why. They weren't being able to play through Kling and Kuika, which is what they really needed to try to do to try to relieve some of that congestion centrally. And I don't know if it's because Kling and Kuika felt like they were getting pinned in by the Spirit's admittedly excellent wing play. The Spirit are really good on the wings. They're really dangerous in wide areas. And so, you know, it may have just been that they felt like they were getting pinned in by that, and they didn't feel like they could take the risks early enough in possession to provide that width for fear of getting beat in behind. But again, that's also why you play with the three, right? You play with three center backs to provide a little bit more cover and to give your wing backs more liberty to take those kinds of early risks than they have when you're playing in a four. So I don't know why that was such a struggle. But it was, and I think you're right that a lot of the credit just goes to the Spirit, both in terms of how they were dangerous in the attack and the way they defended and the way they really locked down the Thorns, in that first half. But I also agree that Morgan Weaver made all the difference there and sort of broke that logjam in the game and made for a really entertaining second half. Second half in which both teams had some very, very near misses and came out with what was in the end probably a fair 1-1 result. But you know, I think that is, you know, we talked about last week or maybe the week before about how, you know, that three-player back line really makes a lot of sense for the Thorns personnel. That's a problem that they're going to have to figure out because the Spirit aren't the only team with good wing play. The Spirit aren't the only team that can bog down a game in the middle. And so I think that's something that Rena's probably going into the week think she needs to figure out with how they're going to play going forward.
Definitely. And I think that Morgan's just constant presence is such a valuable thing for them. Ann Peterson from the AP, she usually sits next to me at Thorns and Timbers games. She commented that that Morgan is like a gnat. You know, she's just always like in your face, won't leave you alone. She's just moving constantly. And I think that's huge. It counteracts a lot of the physicality, I think, that the Spirit bring. And somebody who admittedly, having spoken to her about it, is adjusting to the physicality of the NWSL game is Hina Sugita. She's somebody who has a slighter frame. The game really in Japan, it's really different over in Japan in terms of the physicality. So she talked about that from the jump once she got here, that's something she's going to have to work through. I thought she was better in that game than she has been in the past in terms of, you know, trying to be as physical as she can be given her frame. But there are also moments where she gets so hemmed in and is out physicaled in ways that it really limits her game. And, you know, a lot of what they do goes through her. She's one of the better players on the team. So being able to stymie somebody like that and really keep them, in a position of being essentially a non-factor for a lot of that first half and into parts of the second half, I think that was key. And, you know, Sophia Smith's brilliance is the reason why the Thorns were up 1-0. It's a shame that they conceded the one to bring it back level, but I think another shout out should definitely go to Bella Bixby for her play and goal, and everybody on the team shouted her out after the game because she was just unbelievably tough.
The double save was crazy.
Yeah. I mean, that was insane.
The double save was the best goalkeeping moment we've seen in Portland this year, hands down. Period.
Yeah, and that was after she had banged heads with a player, the player who scored for Washington. So it's
right, Ashley Hatch.
Yes, Ashley Hatch. So they were both down for a couple of minutes there having to recover, and she just pops back up and makes a bunch of incredible saves down the stretch that prevent Portland from taking an L at home, you know? So yeah. She was the person of the match last night, and rightfully so. She set a club record, I think, over 400 consecutive minutes without allowing a score prior to that header that went in from Hatch. So
that's crazy. I totally lost track of that. That's wild.
Yeah, so it's pretty pretty awesome for her to have that distinction, especially given the history of great goalkeepers for this this club. So she's somebody who is unbelievably reliable in that position, and I think that the Thorns can be can rest easy knowing that even if they are still working out the kinks in terms of how they want to approach defending some of these teams that are like Washington, that they've got somebody like Bella back there to hold it down.
It's huge. You know, and the Thorns have also had a decent amount of, obviously they're still working Becky Sauerbrunn back into full fitness. She played 45 minutes, which is, you know, sort of the predictable stepping stone from where she was at. That's kind of the normal buildup. And so, you know, they're figuring out how they're gonna make that work going forward as Becky's gonna be getting into the game more and more. You got to think next time out she'll given the tight turnaround, she might not take a big step up immediately, but over the course of the next couple of weeks, she'll probably be back to full fitness. That's something that is still very much a work in progress, as a lot has been for the Thorns team over the course of this first part of the season. But still, you know, I mean, it's we've been talking a lot about how they look really healthy systemically, even notwithstanding some of these things that you need to figure out, and that's inevitable over the course of every season. But notwithstanding that sort of systemic health and the good work that they've done to generate that so early in what was otherwise a transitional year, they got to get some of these results. And you know, I think you could you saw that in the Challenge Cup against the Rain. You saw that on the weekend against the Rain, and you saw that last night against the Spirit as well. Where, you know, these are good games. They're in good games. They're playing well, they're playing well, pretty well in these good games against good teams. But you got to get some of these results if you want to be where this team can go.
Definitely. And I think there's an opportunity to get a victory on Saturday, another home game for the Thorns against the Houston Dash, 3 p.m. kick at Providence Park on Saturday. You get a win there, then you have a week to prepare to go on the road and play Chicago Red Stars, who are typically a really solid club, and they showed that throughout the Challenge Cup. Then you're back home against Angel City FC, an expansion side that's struggling a bit. That game against Angel City will be on June 3rd. From there, healthy mix of home and road games throughout the months of June and July. A team that has really surprised me in terms of their early season play in NWSL has been the San Diego Wave.
Great.
You can never be surprised fully by a team led by Alex Morgan, but even then, given how they looked in the Challenge Cup, they still did look like a team that had some growing pains to do as an expansion side. But so far this year, they've been great and have shown their mettle.
Yeah, and I think we saw sort of a microcosm of the progression in the one game that we saw in Portland. Where in the first half in that Challenge Cup game, San Diego didn't look on the level, right? You know, I mean, the Thorns crushed them. It wasn't competitive. And in the second half, you really saw a team coming together. And they've looked since then a lot more like that team that we saw in the second half than the team that we saw in the first half in Portland. And so they very much look to be, of the two expansion teams, they're the one that's received less press. And less media attention, notwithstanding the fact that they have some bona fide stars and like Alex Morgan. But they also look like the more coherent of the two expansion teams and yeah, like the one that is more likely to make some noise and to cause some problems on the table.
For sure. And I should say that Angel City FC team, serious home field advantage, something really exciting in terms of the attendance numbers that you see down there at Bank of California Stadium. I think that there's a real desire to continue to build on that in terms of the fan support for that club. So good for them in that regard.
We move on,
yes.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, well, one note on that subject, and this may have been what you were about to bring up, is the attendance numbers at Thorns games to start this season haven't necessarily been where they've been in the past. I don't know if the off-field concerns for fans are contributing to that, or it's just a matter of timing or cost or however that shakes out. But I think that's unfortunate, because this is a very high level Thorns team that has played some exciting opponents in these first trio of home games.
Yeah, it's something that should be getting folks' attention. I know that there are always reasons or excuses, depending on sort of which side of the, you know, how you're looking at it, which side of the coin you fall on. But there are always reasons when you sort of look at one-off games. But yeah, against the Rain, yes, I know the weather was terrible. I was there, albeit undercover, so, kind of sitting in the cheap seats on that one. the weather was terrible, but still, that was a very empty stadium for a Rain Thorns game, and that's not something we're used to seeing. You know, again, last night, midweek game, all of the things that come along with that, but we haven't had and seen too many Rain games, or excuse me, Thorns games, especially against a good team. Over the years that have drawn fewer than 10,000. And although I thought the crowd was lively last night and was bought in, that should be something that should be really setting off some alarm bells. And, you know, I mean, I think we could probably talk until we're blue in the face about why it is. But it should have folks' attention because it's an issue and it should be something that they should be tackling with urgency.
Definitely, because I think there's more room with the Timbers for quote unquote error in that regard, because Timbers games in general draw more of a casual audience to fill in the spaces of fans that might not be showing up as compared with Thorns games. So when you look at those numbers and how they appear, at least visually, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but visually they appear to be significantly less full than they were last year. You know, give it some time, obviously give it a couple weeks, see how trends continue. But it is something that I think needs to be looked at and discussed and examined as to why that is early on in the season.
No question. It's, you know, if you're falling in love and getting drunk on the reasons, I think you're going to miss a bigger picture here. And I hope that's not the case. Where I wanted to go before we move on to the men's stuff, is I think we have to talk about, because it's just such a significant moment. The women's national team and men's national team CBAs just to sort of lead off the segment, that equalize the pay between the women's and men's national teams, and is pretty clever in the way it does it. One of the big issues that we've known about for a long time. We've known for a while that the women's and men's teams were negotiating their CBAs together. So it's going to be a single CBA that applicable to both senior national teams. But one of the big issues that we've known was going to be a challenging one for them to figure out was World Cup prize money. Because the prize money for the last place team in the Men's World Cup is significantly more than the prize money for the first place team in the Women's World Cup, which is obviously a FIFA-driven issue, but it ends up, I mean, having a very, very real effect on the compensation for the women's and men's national team players. They ended up solving that by pooling all World Cup prize money and then distributing it equally between the teams. But, you know, setting aside the details, because the details are interesting only to nerds like me.
Yes.
The details are only interesting to nerds. This is an earthquake in the sporting landscape. This is a transformational moment. And I don't think you can possibly give enough credit to the women's national team players. And it really has been the players that have just been relentless in trying to get this result. They've changed sports, period. Frankly, when they started this fight, and it's been a fight, they have fought every single moment, every single way, every single tool they had, they've used to get this done. It's been difficult. But when they started this fight, and you really started seeing this sort of starting to bubble up around the time that NWSL got going, it had certainly been an issue before that, to be sure. But sort of, I think the modern fight here had started, you know, it probably in the range of 8 or 10 years ago. I remember thinking, this is good. I hope they make progress. I did not take seriously the idea that they might actually fully equalize pay between the national teams, just because the inequalities in sports are so entrenched and so universal that it just seemed like a pipe dream. Holy cow. Like, they did it. Like, unbelievable job. Yeah. Unbelievable job of this group of players who have driven this process, have done something that I don't think we have maybe ever seen in sports. I sometimes I'm kind of cynical about athletes, frankly.
Really? No.
Yeah. Right. Shocker. That's a shocker. And about sport and you know, the way things work within it. And you know, the just the power of athletes within sport. They cut through an awful lot of that cynicism. by doing something that is truly incredible, truly historic, and I think we can hope is just the first break of several glass ceilings in the sporting world. So enormous credit to them. I don't have enough words. Incredible thing that they've done. They are going to get, and future generations are going to get the compensation that they deserve, because of it. But maybe even more importantly, they have completely changed a paradigm in sports. That is cool. And now you think about the possibilities that can flow from this. And it opens up so many doors. So congratulations to them. A supporting actor credit goes to the men's national team for helping this process. But let's be clear, this was led by the women's national team players. They did this, and they deserve just immense credit for making history.
Absolutely. And you think about the hurdles that they faced, and you touched on it, just these baked in institutional blockades, really, that prevent something like this from happening. And just the average person's opinion you ask on this, you know, the average male sports fan who will, you know, come up with all of these ridiculous excuses like, well, they don't do this, they don't do that, they don't generate revenue here, they don't have the TV ratings there. And then systematically, every single one of these women who were involved in this just went box by box, checking off the things, proving why those arguments were completely wrong. And that was the reason, essentially, why they earned this opportunity to equalize pay in a way that has not been seen, as you noted, anywhere in sports. And can pave the way for so much more in terms of not only compensation for these athletes, but, you know, equity of opportunity on television, equity of really people paying attention to the sport and understanding its importance on a level playing field with the men's side. You look at, there's Thorns players past and present who contributed heavily to this. One of them currently is Becky Sauerbrunn. She talked about it last night. Ann Peterson asked great questions of Becky regarding this. And she noted that, you know, she always had hope they would reach this point, but didn't know when it was going to happen, if at all. And there were days where she didn't think it was going to happen while she was still playing, but it did. And there are so many young players who will benefit directly from that. One of them is another Thorn, Sophia Smith, a 21-year-old player who is coming up in this generation. You already see it with her. She's getting sponsorship deals and attention nationally that young up-and-coming stars in the past, even household names like Alex Morgan and others that we know over the years from the U.S. Women's National Team, they didn't have those type of things that early in their career. And you add on top of that this opportunity for equal pay and cashing in on the prize money for what is very likely going to be continual high-level World Cup success for the women's national team and success in all manner of other tournaments. It's a special moment, and it's really exciting for the sport and for these women who are woefully underappreciated and frankly underpaid when it comes to a lot of their professional contracts. And so this is an opportunity for the elite among those in the U.S. to earn what they deserve based on the work that they put in, because it's not easy to balance all this stuff. You know, it'd be easy enough, or difficult enough, I should say, for them to be fully dedicated to their club careers and busting their butts for their teams that they play for in their individual cities. But the time commitment and the hours and energy it takes to bounce around and go play for these national teams, it is a serious, serious thing. It's not just a fun hobby on the side, and they deserve to be paid for it as in full as can possibly be. And this is the case now with this opportunity to be paid equally.
in many ways, it's, I think we lose sight of it because it's just so jarring, but it's impossible to overstate the extent to which these sexist inequalities are just baked into sports all across the sporting landscape, just baked in to the point where they're just what is. They're unexamined in many instances. Yeah, I mean, one example that I just have some personal experience with is NCAA cross country running. Men race 8,000 meters, women race 5,000 meters. There is no reason for it. Like, no reason for it. Somebody years and years ago just decided that that's how it should be, and that's how it still is to this day. And it's because there is just sexism baked into the institution, and it's baked so deeply into it that there's just inertia. And here we are in 2022, and it hasn't changed. That's what they were up against. I mean, that is the depth of the inequality and the prejudice that they were up against in making this change. And it wasn't just about changing the distance of a race. That's an easy change to make, even though it somehow hasn't happened. They were trying to get equal pay for women's sports with men's sports. It is revolutionary. It is groundbreaking and historic, and I can't express even how impressed by them I am. And I mean, the debt of gratitude, frankly, that all of us who care about sport, who love sport, owe to them for doing this, for doing what I thought was impossible. And they've thankfully proved me and so many others wrong. So we all owe them an enormous amount. The players who come after them owe them an enormous amount. I hope people remember this group of national team players that have so diligently pursued this, as the legends that they are, because they're legends.
Definitely. And it's not just this big empty gesture, you know, it's literally lives and livelihoods, and something that I think deservedly so, as you noted, is going to be in the history books in terms of what this means for sport generally on a global scale. Shifting gears a little bit to the Timbers, there's no easy segue here. That was obviously a much more important topic. Yeah, this doesn't mean anything. If you want to stop listening now, that's fine. I don't care. Actually, please do keep listening, but just know that this is seriously not nearly as important of a topic as the one that we just were discussing. So the Timbers on Saturday, 7-2 over Sporting Kansas City. And we'll just start there and move on to the San Jose game later. That was one of the crazier, zanier atmospheres I've ever been a part of at Providence Park. Everything that the fans have felt and gone through early in the season, all the struggles that the Timbers themselves as a team had prior to that game, just disappeared into this like smoke-filled cloud of euphoric glee in front of that that crowd at Providence Park. And it was nuts. 7 goals. It's obviously a club record, as has been noted anywhere and everywhere. If you don't know that by now, then congrats on learning something that pretty much everybody else already knew.
Yeah, Google it.
Google it. Use the internet again for things other than yelling at people. Find some information out. So, just an exciting game. Showcased, I think, the potential of this team against a lowly Sporting Kansas City side that was, in my view, definitely the worst team Portland's played all year. Just not even in the same stratosphere in terms of the way they were defending Portland, and just Swiss cheese defense allowing Nathan Fogassa and Sebastian Blanco to just tear him apart. So fun stuff.
What odds, given the Timbers' form going into this game, what odds would you have given to the Timbers scoring 7 goals Is there a number high enough?
Honestly, if you were to like put that on DraftKings or any other betting site of your choice, I don't even think they would let you bet on that.
Right.
That's how unlikely it is, because obviously, you know, 7 is a club record. 8 is the MLS record set by the Galaxy.
Scored one goal over the previous like 400 some odd all competition minutes.
Yes, it was truly horrific in terms of their ability to score goals before that. So you're talking all those factors in there. I mean, that's like a plus 5,000 at the least, if they even let you bet on it. Like, it's just, or even it could be a plus 10,000 type of prop bet that you're talking about there, which is an astronomical amount of money if you were to even put a dollar on something like that. So you're it's one of those things where you wish you had like a, you know, Back to the Future type situation, sports almanac type thing, and we're able to go back and put money on that, just imagining the riches that would come your way. But yeah, I mean, that's totally unexpected, something like that.
Totally wild. You know, and it was the Timbers played well in the game. I think the only way you get a result like that is if two things happen. The Timbers play very well, and Sporting Kansas City play very poorly. You need both of those to happen in order to get to 7-2, and both of those things happened. You know, it's a little bit unfortunate that we didn't have this conversation before the San Jose game, because I think that that in many ways sort of colors the conversation, but it probably also refines it too. Insofar as you know, that what we can take away from this game is probably a little bit limited. But there are also real things. I thought the Timbers' structure in the game was really, really good. And it showed that when they can have that central midfield of Diego Chara, Christian Paredes, and Eric Williamson, there are real opportunities for this attack and for the team overall. One of the things that I really like about it is it in many ways turns a weakness of a shape into a strength. And what I mean by that is, so a 4-3-3, one of the sort of just like textbook things about it is that if you're defending in a 4-3-3, and the Timbers did that a little bit more in this game than they sometimes do, where even if their attacking shape is as a 4-3-3, they flatten out into a 4-4-2 in defense. And you know, you certainly get to that point. But they did defend a decent amount with a three-man midfield. And the sort of the book on it is the way you attack that is by pushing your fullbacks fairly early, right? In fact, many teams will go to a three-man back line so that they can have wingbacks and they feel like they can really do that. SKC didn't. They sort of stuck to their base set, which is also a 4-3-3, and they pushed their fullbacks on early to try to create width because, that's how you take advantage of having one fewer player in the midfield. You force the central midfielders to rotate earlier. That opens up some space then that you can either play into the channel or continue to play out wide, depending on how the defense reacts. But that's how you do it. That's sort of the textbook weakness in it. The way it turns into a strength, though, especially when the Timbers have Sebastian Blanco on the field, is that starting spot basically right behind that fullback who's pushed on early, that opposing fullback who's pushed on early, is like Blanco's sweet spot. He loves to pick the ball up wide somewhere around midfield or in the midfield and then drive in as he gets into the final third. And he did it over and over and over and over again in that second half. And that's like half of like how the Timbers scored half of their goals, which is just ridiculous, of course, in the way it played out. But it sort of turns that weakness of the shape into a strength and into a counterattacking strength for the Timbers. So I really like that setup. I think it has a lot of potential. I think we saw it again in the second half against San Jose, and it didn't go nearly as well. I think we need to slow our roll to the extent that we're saying, you know, now the Timbers are you know, back to the team that we expected them to be or that they become over the course of the summer. They've still got some work to do. But I think putting a touchdown with the extra point on SKC shows that there is at least a there that the Timbers are reaching toward.
Yeah, and I think that that game in particular, I think it's good to revel in those type of moments and enjoy them for what they are. But to have a little perspective on what that means going forward, and I think that San Jose game provided that type of perspective, like, oh, yep, reality still exists, you know? And we can talk about that more momentarily, but one additional note I had on the 7-2 game was the excellence, obviously, of Nathan Fogassa, and it's been a topic of discussion throughout the week. And the day after, I mean, people were like photoshopping his face.
I'm going to remind you that you repudiated your hot take that he is the answer.
I did, and you know, I think it's important.
Just for the record,
yes, it's important to note that I have no spine and that my opinions are simply at the whim of whatever's happening at the moment. my initial hot take, which I was like semi forced into, was that Nathan Fogassa was, quote, the answer, right? And then, you know, folks were generally a little disappointed with his signing as compared with somebody maybe of a higher level at the striker position. And so I backed up a little bit. I was like, just kidding, guys, no worries. And then, of course, he explodes. Has like the one of the best debuts in team history and looks like the answer. And everybody's talking about it on Twitter, like, oh, I think he is the answer. You know, there were individuals that even said that specifically to us. So it's funny how things work in this up and down zany sport that is Major League Soccer.
You're like Leonardo DiCaprio's character in the Titanic at the end, where You were on this raft, right? Like you had this take. You were on the raft.
There's room for me on the raft.
There was plenty of room for you on the raft. Nothing. Nobody made you jump off. Nobody made you let go. There was on the raft, but you let go for reasons that are unclear. And now you have drowned in your ability to wallow in what would have been a pretty good hot take.
It would have been. It would have made me look like I know what I'm talking about, you know. And it would, I allowed the frigid waters of my insecurity to just drown me. Rose, also known as Nathan Fogassa, just sat on the raft waiting for somebody to join him in his joyful rest of his life.
I like that. Because this is now a Titanic podcast. Like that glaring plot hole has like spun off a whole bunch of conspiracy theories of people trying to explain that.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah, it's wild. I don't know why people, I mean, that is very much a movie that is not aged well and has gone from like winning Academy Awards and people being like, this is one of the best movies in a long time to basically just a series of memes.
Yeah. The art form, Not to get too deep here, you know, you're talking to a person that fashions themselves as a burgeoning cinephile, but the art form has changed so much in the last 25 years that, you know, movies that were viewed as classics at the time, some of them just don't hold up, you know. And maybe, you know, critics kind of panned it at the time anyway. But Top Gun is an example of one. I watched it, and people who follow me on Twitter know that I watched it recently for the first time. I'm one the few people who had not indulged in the hot, sweaty, beach volleyball playing Tom Cruise flick that is Top Gun. I wanted to because I have a desire to see the new one as it comes out. But, you know, movies in general, there are certain ones that hold up because their themes are pretty universal in terms of the human experience and can be watched today with the same type of reverence as if it were to come out today. But ones like Titanic, I mean, most of the reason why it still even really has relevance is the fact that it was a launching point for somebody like Leo DiCaprio, who became essentially Hollywood's last major movie star. You know, movie stars don't exist in the level that they did in the old days. And he's kind of up there as kind of the last old version of what a movie star is, if that makes sense.
I also think that era of movie is visually just super cringy because it was sort of the early years of widespread use of CGI. But it's such bad CGI that like in many ways, those movies, you know, I mean, those movies just are just like visually really difficult to watch, even more so than movies that came before it when they just weren't relying on CGI. Like they look in many respects, a movie from like the late 80s looks better and like looks like a more modern movie than some of those that were in the late 90s and early 2000s when they were sort of like just breaking into this world of CGI. So
yeah, and you know, you look at, you know, not to harp too much on movies here. We'll get back into the soccer momentarily, but
I mean, do you really want to talk about the Timbers game in San Jose?
Not really.
Talk about movies.
No, but I'm happy to do it. You know, fall on that sword for the Timbers fans that are interested. But you look at a movie like Avatar, right? That came out a good many years ago. Was innovative in terms of its use of CGI. The trailer for the second one comes out, and everyone's like, "Oh, cool! You know, Avatar's back and stuff." Doesn't look too dissimilar to the one that came out back then. And at this stage, with the way technology has advanced, particularly with CGI, it looks kind of like a video game cutscene, man. Like it's you're not really getting a lot out of that. Like, whoa, like this is visually stunning. It's like, oh yeah, there's that movie that came out in 2008 or whatever. That's it. There's another one that looks exactly the same. It's like, okay.
Okay, well, back to soccer.
Anyway,
that was quite the tangent.
Yeah, let's pull our ponytails out of the flying dragon things or whatever that they had in Avatar and jump back on the soccer field.
Yes, back to soccer. One last note from the SKC game, and this comes from Mike Donovan, who, you know,
stat
anybody
wizard.
Listening to this podcast, yeah, stat man emeritus. For the Timbers and Thorns. Anybody listening to this podcast, you should know who he is. If not, once again, Google it, although slightly more obscure Google search than Becky Sauerbrunn. but that was Nathan's was the 50th brace in Timbers MLS history, which is, I mean, notable because we like round numbers, but also notable because they still don't have a hat trick in Timbers MLS history. And that's just wild to have 50 braces, 50 players who over the course of the Timbers MLS experience have been on a hat trick and never to have one. That's pretty amazing. And I also just want to have a tip of the cap to Gio Savarese carrying on the Timbers long tradition of subbing off players who are on a hat trick. It's lovely. I love it. I hope it. I mean, I'm at the point where I almost hope. I wish all the success in the world for the Timbers because, unlike you, I am not a neutral journalist.
Right.
I almost hope we keep the streak going because
for the memes alone, exactly.
Because it's just funny, and so you know it'll be fun that one time when somebody gets a hat trick, but we will then lose the joy of this absurdity.
Yeah, and Seba was talking about how he kind of wanted it too. He goes, yeah, but I had a better angle on the pass than the shot. And it's like, dude, you're up like, what, 5-2 or 6-2 at that point? You know, let her rip. Come on. Like, it's just, at that point, in a game like that where you know you're going to get your butt down there and have opportunities, it's just inevitable. I mean, you know, Santi Moreno and Marvin Loria came on late and were smelling blood, and they both scored with no problem whatsoever. It was like a freaking scrimmage against a high school team. So, yes. With all the joy that came with that KC game, brought down to earth, obviously by San Jose, a lot less joy there. You know, if there's something to be said, at least it wasn't a Bobasi that, you know, tore him up. Because that would have kind of been a knife to the heart.
I completely disagree. Even though he didn't get on the score sheet, I thought Jeremy Obobese tore them up.
Okay. Yeah, I you watched more of the game than I did. I was busy with the Thorns. So looking just at those who scored, thankfully, for the Timbers, it wasn't a Bobasi. But even then, you know, a 3-2 loss on the road at a team that is hovering in the same area you are, near the bottom of the West standings, not ideal. You know, you look to get a win out of that, in the hopes of maintaining your momentum that you picked up in that explosion of a game against Sporting Kansas City, and now you are kind of back to where you were.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it was in many ways back to where they were. The Timbers' two goals came off the set pieces, which, hey, like, I'm definitely not among the folks who think that set piece goals like shouldn't count or something like that. They do, and they should. It's an important part of the game, and good on the Timbers because they haven't scored a ton on set pieces except through the one guy, and including the one who scored one of them, Bill Tuiloma, scoring on various free kicks. But corner kicks haven't been super productive for the Timbers, and they scored on two of them in this game. And so I think you can be enthusiastic about that. That's good. But you know, I mean, in the end, the Timbers. Again, I don't love using single game XG numbers, but I'm going to use a single game XG number. Timbers had less than one XG in this game. It's not like the Timbers were creating tons of chances. San Jose was up around two. They were. And so, you know, San Jose winning the game was I think fair. In many ways, I think the Timbers were flattered a little bit by getting two goals and being as in the game as they were, because especially the last half hour or so, it was all Quakes. And you know, I think Jeremy Obobese did really hurt the Timbers in this one. I think on two of the three goals, his fingerprints are all over him. He assisted the first one. He beat Pablo Bonilla and sent in a really good cross. You know, Jackson Ewell is crashing the box. Santi Moreno and Justin Rasmussen don't communicate to track the run. And, you know, that's 1-1, and it was largely because Obobese, A, demanded the ball back from Cade Cowell, and then, B, did some really nice work to get that cross away and to create the goal. The second one was a lot of Obobese. You know, Espinosa gets released in the box to the byline, but what creates the space for Jamiro Montero to just have the entire goal mouth to work with is Jeremy Obobese really crashing the near post, disrupting the Timbers, basically taking both Timbers center backs out of the play by getting that flick on. He doesn't get credited with the assist just because of how it came through. At least he hadn't been as of last I'd seen. That looks like one that deserves a look. But it's because he makes that near post run and because he beats the Timbers center backs to the ball and is able to get a touch on it that the goal happens. And so, you know, the narrative of Jeremy Obobese beating the Timbers doesn't get written just because of the way that worked out. But that's all really great striker play, especially that third goal. That is phenomenal number nine work. And phenomenal number nine work doesn't always just result in goals for the number nine, although that's important, and he's got a lot of them this year. That's phenomenal number nine work, and they got it. And frankly, I think, you know, notwithstanding the narrative, if I'm a Timbers fan, and I am, I would be pretty jealous, having watched that game with Jeremy Obobese up top, and I am. So, you know, to run against the narrative slightly, I do think Jeremy Obobese ate him up in that game. And you know, I mean, it's a San Jose team that's in good form right now, since getting rid of Matias Almeida, which they should have done a year and a half ago. You know, they've been in good form. They're, I think, 4-1-2 over that stretch.
5-1-1.
You know, the 5-1-1, I think, is slightly wrong because it includes a U.S. Open Cup quote unquote win in penalties at Seattle, which should go in the record books as a draw.
Yeah, no, that doesn't count. Never mind.
so you know, there's some liberties taken with 5-1-1, but the point remains regardless. For a team that's otherwise a bottom of the table team, they've been in good form, which you often see after the coaching change. And so, you know, that's saying the Timbers weren't great in this game, and I don't think they were, isn't to take credit away from San Jose. They're genuinely playing better. And in this one, I thought, you know, in terms of actual influence on the final scoreline, Jeremy Obobese is my number one in terms of who influenced the result.
For sure. And you know, I think that from what I saw on Twitter, there were folks that were pleased with what they saw out of Nathan Fogassa as the number nine for Portland. Somebody who had forced himself into positions and earned corners that led to scores. Bill Tuiloma is now and has been the leading scorer for this club, which
it's not great.
Not great.
I mean, good for Bill. Like
good. No, yeah, that kicks
taking
ass.
Nothing away from Bill. Bill, good job, Bill. Bill. Not great for the team.
Bill is a great guy and has a good attitude and is a really fun player to watch and a specialist really in those spaces. So you know you need somebody like that. But do you want him to be your leading goal scorer? No,
you do not.
No, you do not. You need somebody in the attacking third that can finish those goals and do so on a consistent basis. Will Nathan start to do that? Who's to say? I don't think that he's going to be repeating his brace performance anytime soon. But he seems like somebody who is of MLS caliber. He's
for sure.
He's definitely, you know, there were question marks about that with the signing. Is he just going to be kind of, you know, filling in and showing that he's not really fully ready? I think he's ready. I think that he's somebody that even when Yarrow comes back, depending on how he plays for the remainder of these games leading up to that return, he's somebody you have to give a look at in terms of being the legit fill-in starter until Felipe Mora comes back.
Yeah, I think that's right. I haven't seen anything that makes me want to sort of disrupt what we've seen in the last couple of games. I think it's worth a longer run out. And I agree that Nathan Fogassa, as it seems like the Timbers recognized pretty early on once they got him into Portland, looks like an MLS player. I don't know if he's an MLS starter or if he's a contributor, but he certainly looks like he's one of those. And so I think we've seen a lot of Yaroslav Nizhgoda, and he sort of had his shot, and I think it makes sense to sort of keep running with this to see if Nathan can give you something more. I genuinely don't know the answer to that question yet, but I'm more interested in that question than I am interested in whether Nizhgoda can turn things around.
Right, and I think that Nizhgoda is somebody who can absolutely be a piece to move once the off season comes around, somebody that makes sense to move to open up a DP spot.
Or the summer window.
Yeah, in the summer window.
We don't have to wait till the winter.
No, we don't have to wait till that long. It can very much and probably will happen this summer. And that is kind of a transition into my hot take. We're gonna have a nice little hot take section for you this week, folks.
We should probably keep it brief given how long we droned on about Titanic and stuff
and Avatar and stuff. Yeah, so we'll keep it brief. My hot take, and there may be a number of Timbers fans who agree with me on this, is that the big move in the summer should be for a defensive player. It should, if you're going to make a big move, a signing that is going to be a difference maker, I think you look along that back line, probably somebody at the right back position, given how much Bonilla and Van Ranken have struggled at that spot. That to me should be the biggest signing. I get the desire to have a big splash, holy crap, this guy's amazing type of young striker, but I think their money may be better served spent elsewhere, especially given that, you know, when he was healthy last season, Felipe Mora was a guy that was pretty dang reliable. I mean, if it weren't for him, they wouldn't have had a chance in MLS Cup to even get to the point where they were in penalties, you know? So it's not just to isolate that one moment. Obviously before that he was solid as well, but I think their money is best served on the back line when it comes to this summer.
Because I mostly just speak in sort of a stream of memes, my response to that is, why don't we have both? I think you're right that the Timbers are going to need to make an addition on the back line. Right back is the, you know, sort of most glaring spot where that seems to exist. They also need to find more consistency in central defense and at left back, but I think a lot of that has been driven by injuries and COVID and suspensions and things like that. You know, that need to get cleaned up, and various people are sort of responsible for making sure they get cleaned up.
Van Ranken.
But yeah, I mean that's the glaring one of where they need to make a move. I do think though that the Timbers need to continue doing the legwork, at least to explore the possibility of a major signing in the attack in the summer window, which would necessarily involve Nijgoda being transferred elsewhere. And I think that remains something that they need to continue sort of doing the legwork on, so that if they do get to July and you know, maybe Nathan doesn't sort of prove to be kind of the MLS caliber striker that we hope and expect him to be based on early returns. Maybe Mora is going to be longer coming back. Maybe he's going to take some time to get in form, or maybe they just feel like they need, you know, a truly elite presence at number nine, which I think is, there's a decent argument for, given sort of the composition of the rest of the attack. I think they need to continue to sort of, you know, kick the tires on the kinds of signings that would be that kind of thing in the summer. I agree with you that, you know, that there is a world in which that ends up not being the most sensible move to actually pull the trigger on. But I don't think we're going to know which world we're living in until we're closer to the window.
Right. And I think there is there's definitely money there to be spent.
Yes, which leads directly into my hot take. So I don't watch a ton of Premier League, mostly because I watch a lot of other soccer, and so it's a little bit difficult to always work into the budget. But you know, I do sort of casually watch games as I can on Saturday and Sunday mornings and the like. And one of my favorite chants that you hear every once in a while, I think it's my favorite chant. It's my favorite chant in soccer. When you hear it. Is when you hear supporters of a team and they're not happy with the personnel decisions that have been made, and they're not happy with the investment that comes in. Once in a while, you'll hear the delightful chant of "spend some bleeping money." I say bleeping only because this is a family show. Family. They don't say bleeping in real life, but I'll let you all fill in the blanks there. So to the Timbers, I say, spend some bleeping money. Not really, but look, we did have the twice a year MLS salary drop come out this last week, and as has been the Timbers have been sort of slowly moving back in the total salary spend category relative to other MLS teams over the course of the last few years. But this time they're third to last in the league, 26th, which, you know, for sort of long-term followers of the Timbers, that is not how it used to be. The Timbers used to be reliably somewhere in the top third of that salary spend. And we do this every year, but we have to caveat this. Salary spend is not the only spend. There are other things that the team spends money on, transfer fees and the like are the biggest one. And so this is only a partial picture of the Timbers' overall spend. Just because they're not spending a lot on salaries doesn't mean that they aren't near or at the salary cap, largely because of just the way DP compensation works and the like. And so it can both be true that the Timbers have a tight salary cap situation and that they're not spending a lot of money on salaries. And, you know, as sort of a third point, and this is very much what Gavin Wilkinson would say if he was here, is that that's going to be a little bit variable. Your salary spend is going to be a little bit variable. And the Timbers salary spend right now is a little bit lower because they have a core that's been intact for a while, right? So Sebastian Blanco is a player for whom they don't have any acquisition cost right now because they re-signed him after having him previously on a contract. You know, and he's a player who's making $1.7 million, who, if signed by another team, would probably be making more than that. And they have a number of players like that who are, you know, players that have been here for a while. Diego Chara. I mean, if Diego Chara was signed 2 years ago by Real Salt Lake, they'd be paying him $1 million+. The Timbers pay him, I think, around $600,000, if I remember that right. And so, you know, that's all good and correct. And you can certainly have sort of kind of an ebb and flow in the amount that a team is spending on salaries. that isn't necessarily reflective of the ambition that they're actually putting into their roster. All of that said, the Timbers can't make a habit of being, you know, in the bottom third of the league in terms of spending. They don't have the academy to do it. They don't have the domestic pipeline to do it. They can't make a habit of this. And so if this is a bleep, that's fine. Or if this is just sort of not a bleep, that's what goes into the chant. A blip.
A blip?
If this is a blip, that's fine. It might also be a bleep, but you know, if this is a blip, I don't think that's particularly troubling. But if this is going to be how it is going forward, the Timbers are in for rough seas ahead. And to their credit, they've gotten results so far. Three finals in the last 7 years, one MLS Cup, one MLS's back trophy, whatever that's worth. So the Timbers have gotten results. So it's not like the low salary spend or the decreasing salary spend relative to the rest of MLS has you know been hampering for the team. But it will be if it continues sort of into the long-term future. And so my hot take is spend some bleeping money. Because I think the Timbers are going to have to if they want to remain competitive over the course of the medium and long term.
And we will see if they do. We'll look ahead to the summer as a potential opportunity for that. And that will wrap it up for us today on Soccer Made in Portland. For Mr. Chris Reifer, I'm Ryan Clark. Thanks for joining us, and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review. Tell us how we're doing. Tweet us if you have something nice to say, or even if you have something mean to say. We'll read it and move on with our day. Thanks again for joining us.
A mean tweet segment would be kind of fun.
Mean tweet segment would be fun. I haven't gotten enough of them since most Timbers fans are very kind and, you know, level-headed individuals. So maybe, well,
I agree, but not everybody would agree.
Not everybody would agree with that. Yeah. I'm just going to leave that there. Don't want to open up a can of worms, but appreciate everybody for listening, and we will see you next week.